no matter how hated you feel, you should go on loving, because again, that is the spiritual mandate of Christ. And if you aren't able to do that, you know, you need to strip back your faith and start over at formula, at ground zero. That's what we need to be focusing on.
Hi guys, welcome back to my channel and welcome to another Tea Talk. I'm very excited for today's Tea Talk. And like I said at the beginning, calling it another Tea Talk almost doesn't feel right, because I'm very excited, like I just said, to be talking to Brent McCorkle. Hi, Brent, and welcome to
the channel. Thanks for having me on, man. So if it's tea talk, do we get to like spill the tea? You know, is that like part of it? So,
you know, kind of. I was gonna say I have my tea. That sounds like the cooler way to describe it. Like we're gonna talk tea, and maybe that is what's about to happen. But in general, I'm not really that much of a tea talker. I just really like tea. It's very basic.
I love it, man. Well, yeah, we have ongoing disputes. You know, I'm married and have five kids, so we have ongoing disputes of tea versus coffee. So we have the entire gambit in the family for sure.
I'm going to guess you're the coffee person.
I do love a good coffee. I can be talked into tea, though. I just kind of roll with it. Like if one of my kids just wants to go to a tea shop, I'll like hit some hibiscus or some chamomile.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, I don't have like... what's funny, right? Because I'm not really a Republican or a Democrat. Like I try to get down with everybody, you know? And so I'm kind of like that with coffee and tea. Like if you take me to a tea shop, we're going to get down on some tea for sure.
I really appreciate that, because my husband's not so much in the tea camp. And I'm like, dude, there is some really good tea. You can't lump all teas in together as one, because even though I'm a tea fan, there are some teas I don't love so much. So I appreciate your openness to tea.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny on humanity side, right? Like I'm definitely a dog person and not a cat person. And yet there are some cats that will reach me.
I love this animal, right?
So you can't lump all cats into like demon category, right? There's some very beautiful cats out there and there's some terrible dogs. And so.
Dude, we're starting off deep. This episode is beginning. This has gone from tea to like, don't lump everyone into one.
That's right.
But that's a good way to open this. And that is really appropriate for your film that just came out, like the whole conversation, the context of this conversation. So, okay, just to give a little information for people that are watching that are like, who's Brent McCorkle? Like, Nikki's having this talk about tea. What's happening? Let me give you a little backstory. So Brent is a director and apparently a producer and apparently a composer and a screenwriter and editor. I was really impressed when I just rewatched I Can Only Imagine. I was like, oh my gosh, he's an editor on this movie. And I know that I'm just a YouTuber, but I'm also like a cinema fan. And I have a real thing for editing. And when you're watching a movie and the editing isn't right, you're like, it wasn't the right moment. And so side note, I realize I'm getting off track with your intro, but when I saw you edited I Can Only Imagine as well, I was like, oh man, this makes sense. His editing is great. So yes, all of those things. And recently, the reason that Brent and I got connected is because he was a co-director on The Jesus Revolution. And I was not expecting to go to that movie. To be honest, it hadn't even really crossed my radar. And I'm not sure if it's because in general, there's kind of this history, and I know you've talked with people about this, with certain Christian films not being up to maybe the artistic standard that some of us might hope. I don't know if that's why, but it wasn't really on my radar. And my mom called me one weekend and was like, I'm going to see The Jesus Revolution. Do you want to come with me? I was like, well, sounds great. Haven't been to the movies in a minute. Love Jesus. I can go and my husband can watch my son. And I was blown away. Like, to say the least, I was blown away. There were so many things, and we're going to talk about a lot of this, obviously, in this interview. But like I mentioned kind of at the top, or maybe I didn't mention, maybe I inferred it, the quality of all of the things that you and your team executed in this film, everything from the cinematography. I mean, I said to my mom when I left, I was like, Mom, there were like multiple times in that film where I was like, whoa, I just got chills thinking about it. Like that was a beautiful shot. And you don't always see that. Like I said, I don't want to slam Christian movies, but I don't find myself always seeing Christian films and being like, wow, that's an image. That's beautiful. And then, you know, even more importantly than that, because I think it's both actors and directing and editing, even though I just heard recently you guys got some of those things in one shot, but the authenticity of the emotions that were conveyed in this film from these actors was just, it was just really well executed. And I feel like at this point you might be a smidge sick of hearing that, because as I've been deep diving your interviews, everyone's saying the same thing. Everyone's like, oh my gosh, the quality of this film. But it's true. And I was really blown away. And so that was a very long intro to say, that's who Brent McCorkle is, director of The Jesus Revolution, director of I Can Only Imagine, co-director, editor. You tell me if I'm missing anything, the whole shebang. But yeah, sorry, awkward, long intro, but I wanted to like paint the picture.
Thank you so much. Yeah. One guy interviewed me this week, threw me under the bus. And as a joke, he just to kind of burn me through in caterer. He's like, yeah, Brent was the editor, producer, director, editor, caterer. You know, he just threw that as a joke, but I'll do it all, man.
You kind of were a caterer probably, huh? Because you were keeping this set going.
Like, yeah, man. No, dude, food is crucial on set for sure. Yeah. No, man, I appreciate those kind words. I am generally not a fan of Christian movies. Mm. I was dragged kicking and screaming into the space, you know, but I really felt like maybe this is where I'm supposed to be. And I really have settled into it. And I'm just trying to make it the best that it can be, because there's no reason why a film about your faith or your spirituality or God should be any less than any of the other films you go to the cinema, right? Anything, it should be better.
Exactly.
If you're going to attach like Jesus or faith or your spirituality to something, like,
yes,
why would you skimp on the actual trade craft of Hollywood? Like, plus, I'm just a Hollywood fan. I love Hollywood movies. I love big cinema. And so I aspire to that myself. And you know, John Irwin, the other director, man, he loves the audience so much. And so, yeah, man, we just worked on it. And then, you know, in addition to all the things you said, it really is about your team, because I can do as much as I can as a director. I can put in my 16 to 18 hours like everybody else. But man, at the end of the day,
yes,
it's a giant pirate ship with 400 seats on it. And everybody has a vital, crucial role to play. And yes, luckily, every 400 seat, you know, on this pirate ship was filled with excellence and quality and just beautiful people that were there to work really hard. And as to the authenticity of performances, man, it just, everybody brought it, you know. It was just, it was amazing to watch. And sometimes, you know, you're trying to shepherd this thing and guide everybody and lead everyone, but sometimes you're just observing beauty happening, you know. And it was pretty amazing just to be in the middle of all this and see it all go down. Because, you know, the truth of the matter is, it takes just as much hard work to make a bad movie as it does a good movie. They're just hard to make.
You know? That's so good.
One turn out good, it makes you like very happy and grateful. And I think it should humble you, honestly, because, you know, I think oftentimes egotistical directors go out and take an outsized amount of credit. Because of pride and ego and hubris, and like, I'm just not that guy. I'm grateful for my team. I'm grateful that it all worked. And you know, if every filmmaker in the world in Hollywood knew what makes a film work, they would just make hit after hit. But we just don't ever know if it is going to or not.
And yes,
you have a feeling about it, but at the end of the day, man, it should humble you when one's doing good out there, or when one comes together in a way like it did on our movie, for sure.
Isn't that the weirdest part, side note, about making art? That it's this combination of like just dedication, hard work, showing up, putting in the time, getting scrappy. But then also there's this element of like magic and not really sure why something happens at the right time in the right moment. And like you said, directors, yes, they, you know, they get a lot of credit for running the films, or maybe some of them might get big-headed, but it's both, right? Because the director is so important, which is part of why I was so excited to talk to you, because I've worked with a couple of, you know, I haven't done like a ton of movies or shows or whatever, but I've done enough to where it's like, I really admire that role when I'm on set. It's like, they're really driving the ship. But at the same time, exactly, if you've got a great director, but like other people aren't pulling up and doing their part, then it's just not going to come together. And you could really see everyone's hard work and dedication like just through so much of it. And like my fake filmmaker mind, I was just pulling apart so many things, like, oh man, that was so great. Or like the music. Sorry, now I'm bebopping all the way around, but like the music was really great too. And I was re-reminded of that also when I watched I Can Only Imagine, because I was like, oh man, the music for this film is totally different than the music for Jesus Revolution, which makes sense. But sorry, I tend to do this. I spin off 12 different directions. I just like, yes, yes.
I love it, dude. I love it. Oh, thanks for mentioning the editing too. It's a dark art that doesn't get enough love. And totally. One of my best friends in the world edited Jesus Rev. I edited I Can Only Imagine with Andy. I helped edit on this uncredited a little bit with John. And yeah, man, editorial is where it all happens. You know, there's a saying in
I know exactly what you're gonna say. Are you about to say the editors like win Academy Awards for actors? Or did I just cut you off?
That's a great one that I'm going to steal, actually. No, it's very true. It's very true, man. Like you're putting up, you know, you're putting up the actor's greatest hits, you know, yes. You're often like being really careful with them, and you're curating all their best moments right into the thing. That's what an editor, that's not like a gift an editor gives anybody. That's their job.
Totally.
But no, you're exactly right, man. Like sometimes you do have to cut around stuff and help them. Other times you don't. Other times it's just gold. But no, what I was going to say was a film really gets made four times, once in the writing, once in actually how it got shot, once in the edit. And then I add a fourth one once when you score it, because the score can make a scene feel a completely different way. So I think remaining true to the intent and the authenticity in the score, I think is a trick. It's definitely a trick in and of itself. But yeah, you get a chance to completely reimagine your movie from the ground up, you know, in editorial, as you know, because you're doing a fair share of editing.
I'm doing like my own mini filmmaking. That's what I call it. Like, it's me making films in my home.
I love it, man.
It's such a gift. I remember when I was little and I would edit, my mom would just be like, why can't you just make videos for a living? You really like this. But that was like way pre-YouTube. So it's very like shocking that this is a thing nowadays. I'm very grateful. I was going to ask you something. Oh, you said scoring. So you don't score the movies, or at least that's not your workflow typically, until after the film is done.
That's traditionally how movies are made. Yeah. You put in what's called temp track oftentimes, or sometimes you don't, but like the editor will go in and find a piece of music that he likes that maybe sets the tone. And then the composer listens to that and you have a chat with the director, which was a crazy process on this one, because John was working on other stuff. So I'm the director and the composer. So it was like me talking to myself. He was like, is this good? You know, is this good? I don't know. So it was crazy. But yeah, that's generally funny. You have a chat with the director and you agree basically materially on how you want the scenes to feel and move. So yeah, the score is almost like the icing on the cake when it's all put together.
That's very interesting.
But there have been non-traditional ways of doing it where you just tell the composer just the general direction we go and they'll go off and just start making music. And sometimes, you know, the editors will bring that in and it will work in the film. So I've heard of movies doing that before. With documentaries, that's how I'll do it. I'll start cranking music and send it to the editor and the director, and they'll start trying to find places to put the music in. But in features, it's called scoring to picture. And I would say 98% of the movies in Hollywood are score to picture.
Interesting. Okay, so that leads me to where like my brain is kind of going next, and we're going to circle back to talk more about like the specifics of Jesus Revolution and a little bit about I Can Only Imagine, because I just rewatched it. But I kind of want to back up a little bit. It's in line with what we're talking about. I don't think I'm making this up. I think I heard somewhere in my random internet sleuthing over you that you are essentially self-taught in regards to production. Am I making that up?
Well, no. In large aspects, yes. I did take some film classes, to be fair. I was in Texas at the time, and I went to a liberal arts college. I took a bunch of film classes, and I dropped out. I'm a college dropout. Let's just, full transparency.
Love
and,
it.
Truth. But And I did learn a lot there. I learned a lot academically, probably more than practically, but I learned how to shoot and how to light and everything running around in the woods with my friends, making little dumb short films. That was my upbringing.
I
That's
love
the way
that.
I came up. Just weekend warrior, borrowing cameras. I was pretty broke. I was married, single income. I had a bunch of little kids and a mortgage. And on the weekends, man, I was just chasing it hard. And I had a bunch of non-filmmaker friends, non-actors that I thought could just do it. And I would throw my non-actor friends into my little shorts. I would get my kids to act for me. And we messed around, and a couple of my shorts got in front of Spielberg, and he liked them. He liked a couple of my shorts and freaked us all out because they're my friends from church, you know? And I'm like, guys, Spielberg just saw your acting and he liked it, you know? So anyway, it just blew our minds, you know? It blew our minds because we're just running out the woods with no money and borrowing gear. And yeah, our shorts kind of some of them made the rounds. And it's cool to see. You know this from your own experience. And I mean, I think we communicate this to a lot of your audience because by and large, humans are dreamers. We're dreamers. We have big dreams. And you know, the saddest life you could have is to at least not risk and try. Like we should all try. So when your mom's like, oh, wouldn't it be cool if you could have, and now you're doing it, you know, but like, I'm sure if you sat there and talked about your story, there's probably lots of trial and error, lots of experimentation, and lots of figuring out what it is that you want to say and how you want to say it. And so yeah, my whole thing was running around the woods with non-film friends, just making dumb little story, shooting dumb little short stories on cameras, you know?
I mean, that hearing that is not that surprising, not only because I had heard little bits of that before, but also because you, first off, the scrappiness I think has served you. Because I also, correct me if I'm wrong, but I heard that this movie only had about a $15 million budget. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yes.
Sorry,
Yeah.
go on.
And, oh, well, I was going to say, John Irwin is a scrapper too.
Love it.
He, his dad gave him a camera when he was 15 and told him he had to like shoot stuff and I think pay his dad back, you know, for the
Oh.
camera. And he ended up sling him and his brother ended up slinging cameras for ESPN. So they were just shooting sidelines
What does that
on
mean,
crew,
slinging cameras?
like just holding camera, like shooting on
Oh.
crews, but you know, they were just shooting sports crews like basketball, football, NFL, and they were these camera guys, you know, but it makes you really scrappy because sometimes you'll run out of light, you'll run out of time, you'll run out of money. And these blue collar instincts that we both have, like just growing up on the street with not a lot of money and you know, having very finite resources at your fingertips, it's a very blue collar approach to filmmaking, and I think it served us both well because even on bigger budgets, you're gonna run out of time and money. It's just all scaled. So if you had J.J. Abrams on here, he would complain about his schedule and the money on like a big Star Wars movie or whatever. You're always gonna feel like you don't have enough time, you don't have enough money. You know, there's always some kind of pressure. There's something that's going to give way, you know, and you're going to run out of something material that you need to finish. And so your scrappiness comes in handy in those times.
That's like some down home wisdom right there. My mom always said, she's from Iowa, and she always said that her mom used to say something along the lines of, like, you're going to spend what you make. You're always going to go up to it. Like, you have to learn how to live below it. I know that's different because we're talking about film here, but you saying that feeling like these bigger directors can still max it out. And the thing is, we know that just because you throw money at something doesn't make it good art either, or a moving story. And so, yeah, that scrappiness obviously served you. And from my lens, obviously, as a pseudo filmmaker, like, it shows that you guys made it happen. And part of what I mean by it showing is even in like the acting, in the sense that, like, I saw in one of your interviews, you said, like, someone's like, what makes a good actor? And you were like, I have to believe them. Like, that's what it comes down to. And I just think about that married with what you were just saying about like shooting your church friends. It's like, of course, the craft of acting can be studied so deeply, and I admire amazing actors so much. But I do think that like the right person, the right time, the right director, like you can capture that authentic emotion. And you guys clearly knew how to do that from your scrappy days, you know, because some of those scenes, man, sorry, I don't know if I'm skipping ahead here. No, let's keep talking about this. I'm going to keep talking about this. So you, yeah, self-taught kind of. You went to the liberal arts school. You shot on the weekends. Where does the music come into play here?
Well, I was a musician before I wanted to do film. I always say as a joke, you know, I'm a musician who happens to make films for a living. But
oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, my background is I was raised in the church. I was raised in a like a charismatic Pentecostal persuasion, and they loved all the people to get into the thing, you know. I was playing piano for the church at a young age and singing. I got to play drums. I taught myself a little bit of guitar and bass. And I was raised in a very nurturing environment. I don't know if you know the writer Malcolm Gladwell, but he basically says if you can apply 10,000 hours of reps and heavy lifting and to anything that you want to do, you'll become good at it.
Yeah.
If you have a natural ability, right? So I did. But my 10,000 hours occurred in the church. And I mean, I had a youth pastor. He just saw my talent, man. Like one day he came in, he's like, "Hey man, I know this is crappy. It's like a $50 guitar, but I just want you to have it." He gave me an acoustic guitar. And I flipped out. I mean, no one had ever given me a guitar before. And like, but the thing was, I went home with it, immediately started trying to learn it. And I was like, I need guitar lessons. But like, that was the environment I was in. He later gave me a synthesizer, you know? So he just saw it in me. You know, my parents saw it in me, obviously paid for, you know, tons of music lessons and that kind of thing. And also just gave me a platform in the church to probably play really terribly at the beginning and sing really terribly, right? We have to start somewhere. Mm-hmm. And the church was like a soft landing zone for me to start out. And if you look at shows like America's Got Talent, American Idol, a lot of those kids have roots in the church. And I think
Yeah.
A similar analog, right? Mm-hmm. Of we just got a lot of trigger time in as kids growing up and got to sing and play a lot. And I definitely have mixed emotions about cultural Christianity in the West, but that particular part of my upbringing, I'm very, very proud of. And I think it's just beautiful legacy and it made me who I am today for sure.
Yeah, it's interesting. That's amazing. I think there's something really interesting about the whole like artists coming up in the church. I think it's different than just being part of like a local theater group, although that's great. I did a lot of local theater growing up. It was fun, but I think it's very different, not only because of the obvious like spiritual element of like everybody that's there is worshiping the creator of the universe. I think it adds a depth to someone's like intro into art, you know, because even as a kid, I think sometimes I remember being little thinking certain things were stupid, certain scripts or whatever. But when you're in church, like the ability to express yourself and practice, like you were saying, but like there's a reverence and we all know what we're doing here and we're praising the creator of the universe. I think it like brings a lot of depth out of a lot of creators. I don't know. I've been listening to a lot of biographies lately, and you're totally right. So many of them start in the church, and I think that's really interesting. So that's cool. That's where you got your hours.
Yeah, I agree with you. And you're right. It's not just about me getting my hours and thank you for pointing this out, but it's like, this is important.
Yeah.
And there are sacred things to this life and there are holy things to this life. But when you approach this piano and you put your mouth on that microphone, it's more than just the notes. There's something bigger happening here. And I still carry that with me today for sure.
Yes. You totally do. It comes out in your films, but keep going. Yeah.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right to call that out, man. You're right. It's more than just being a fussy artist or walking through a museum being critical of things. There's like a holiness to it. And to be able to create, isn't that cool, you know? Like with a creator imbuing us with that ability to be creative and to create, and it is holy and it's sacred. It should be looked upon as such. And also I think everybody to some degree is creative. And I think some of the saddest beings is when that's like repressed and they never find that. Because like, I man, you know, it, even an accountant or somebody that you would make fun of is like a bean counter or like has an abacus or whatever. Like,
Yes.
I guarantee you, if you get into their life, they're
Dude.
creative. They're probably creative in their accounting, you know?
Yes,
It's like,
yes. 100. It's so interesting because my husband is like that engineer minded, like very, I mean, I don't know how you'd describe him. Engineer minded is the perfect way. We're very different in some ways, but it's always fascinated me that, like, I mean, his dad is even a great example. His dad is very similar, very engineer minded, very like type A, a little nerdy, you know, but they're artists and they create very differently than I do. And luckily they've both been able to tap into that even through that, like, is Poindexter a bad word? You get what I'm saying? Like that very like focused way. It's just a different way of creating art. And it really is beautiful because it's really shown me through, especially through my husband, how creating doesn't look like one thing, you know? And that's obvious, right? Because creating is like, there's a lot to it, but he's got such a different personality than me. And seeing him put together like beautiful pieces of art, not only around our home, but he's also a musician and he approaches music so differently than me. It's been very humbling is a good word again. It's like, man, artists and people really approach art differently. And God made us all real different to focus on different things. And yeah, I don't
Yeah.
even know where I'm going with that.
No. I think, dude, to piggyback off that, like, there's a composer that I don't really care for, but people weep when they hear his music. But he's a mathematician. His name is Philip Glass. But like, he approaches everything from a very mathematical perspective. But if you look at music, it's math. It's just math. If you look at the universal language of what we know, it is math. It's like there are math equations holding all of this together. So if we didn't have math, we wouldn't have tonality, music wouldn't even work. And so there's a crazy mathematical approach to even music that touches people on a fundamental level. I don't get down with that. I come at it from a totally different place. But what's so interesting about it, and I'm saying the exact same thing as you, that doesn't make Philip Glass less than in any way. It actually more than, because he's touching people with the way that he works, the way that he hears, the way that he experiences the universe. He has a totally different experience than me. That's what makes like humanity so robust. And like, he can reach people emotionally with his
In a
stuff that
different
I will
way.
never reach with my stuff. So.
Totally. And like my husband, we've had these conversations like multiple times about math and music. I'm like, I
Yeah.
know, but I'm not there. But it's funny because like God has used him and his way of approaching art to call more out of me, to like make me step up in these areas of like technique all across the board, honestly, where it's like, oh man, like he's really asking more of me, and then I'm like pushing to step up to it. So it's just interesting how we all kind of refine each other even when we approach things so differently.
Yes,
Or maybe
yes.
that's why we refine each other. I don't know how I got off onto this. I keep going off, but I'm glad you're vibing.
No, I love all of this, but it makes our experience together more robust, because I always tell people, even in film, but in life, right? Like, life and your career, it's like a hypothetical Mount Everest. So in the real Mount Everest, you can only climb it two ways. In one way, you're almost sure to be killed. It's a much tougher way than the other way. You know, a few people make it or whatever. But in life and career, it's a hypothetical Everest where you could summit it millions of different ways. There's no right way up the mountain. There's your journey and the path that you're on. So we fail each other when we're like, oh, well, you should be doing it like me, because you know, I play by ear, and like, your way is too mathematical. No. It's the way I'm doing it. It's the way you're doing it together, the separate ways, right? It's very beautiful, because there's just such a vastness to the way that, you know, we see things, we hear things, we experience things as humans. And I've been getting down on that a lot more in the last few years, and I've really been enjoying like embracing the differences.
Well, because there's been a lot of craziness, and there's been a lot of divide between people in the country, and I'm like, do I even go off on this tangent? It's like some of the
Yeah,
divide I
please do.
understand. I mean, yeah, it's something I told my husband. I was like, I don't even know if I'm going to bring this up on the call because it almost feels like I don't know how much do we even want to dive down that, but I've seen, you know, it kind of relates to the film and also what's going on just in the country in the last couple of years. I've seen that there's obviously some people within the faith that are like kind of tearing apart, not tearing apart the movie, but they have their criticisms or they're throwing in with their, you know, their notes. And I just told Dan, I'm like, man, I understand that there are reasons. I mean, we've had a couple of things in the last few years where it's like, there are reasons sometimes for people to part or to divide. I get it. But the amount of hate that is slung around at people for not sharing the same perspective, not landing on the same conclusion, or not being perfectly in line with how they see things is mind-blowing to me. Like, you know, I've heard a few people reference just Calvary Chapel in general kind of being like a little bit of a kicking off point for more of the charismatic movement. And just in full transparency, like, I wouldn't consider myself charismatic. My husband was raised in a very charismatic household. His parents really are still in that line of faith. But it didn't, like, I still loved it. And so when I've seen people make these kind of divisive comments, I'm like, I don't even understand how you're tearing apart something that was so positive and uplifting. Like, you're creating a divide for what? Anyways, wow, I really am going off. I don't know if you have anything you want to say back or if that was a totally different direction than what you expected.
No, I'm actually got to bridle myself here because it's one of the main reasons why I made the film. There's a political addiction right now in this country across the entire political spectrum. You have people putting politics over their faith and they don't even see that they're doing it. But you get around people like that, they're talking about politics more than they're talking about Jesus, or actually having to, you know, how can Jesus help me be a better human being? How can I be love and light and the hands and feet of Jesus to the hurting people of the world? It's not really about that. It's about, you don't vote like me, you're the enemy.
I know.
And so I'm very sad for our country. You know, we have the fentanyl addictions, we have the opioid addictions, we have all that stuff, but we also in this country we have an addiction to being right and being politically, you know, politically activated, and this rage and, you know, this anger and this hate, people that don't believe the same way as you. And man, it's just, number one, it's just not a good reflection of Jesus. I mean, obviously it's on both sides, but yeah, man, I would talk to you about this forever. And, I knew that our little sweet little movie would get co-opted into the culture wars, and it has on both sides for sure. I mean, there have definitely been people on both sides attacking our movie, and I knew that would be the case just because of the times in which we live. And yet, if you just take the movie by itself and you watch it, it really is a call for love and acceptance, belonging, compassion, and empathy. And I wish I could get people wake up to this fact, but if you look at the sacred text of Christianity and you compare it to all the other world religions, it mentions love more in its text than any other world religion. And yet it's not presenting that way, it seems to me, in some of the loudest Christian voices in America. And so, yeah, man, I could just go on and on about it. And, you know, it doesn't help for me to be angry about it, because that's, you know, it's like that beautiful Martin Luther King quote about the death penalty, but he basically said, hate can't drive out hate. Dark can't drive out dark. Light drives out dark. Love drives out hate. Only love can do it. And so if you look at it, I mean, everything I did in the movie was in the spirit of that MLK quote. Like, the only way to really push back darkness is with light, and to push back hate is with love. And, like, you know, for me, this movie is a sincere call back to the church, a gentle call back to the church. Like, hey, let's get back to love. Let's get back to looking at how Jesus actually conducted his life and was out with the people. You know, I always tell people, if Jesus had just been a rabbi like everybody else, he would have taught in the church, right? And just taught in the synagogues of his day. We wouldn't have a religion built around him. Like, his entire ministry was outside the church walls, and he was so criticized by the moralists and the legalists and the religious community of his day, because he just didn't move like everybody else did. He was outside the church walls of his day, like, meeting the needs of people. And there's a verse that I love about, a story that's told about him, but he said he looked upon the multitudes and he was moved with compassion. But if you break the Greek down, he was physically feeling their pain. He empathetically feeling all of their hunger and their sadness, their destitution. It was in his body and it doubled him over with pain.
Physical pain.
Yeah. And so why don't we focus on that? We can't, because man, like the hate in our country, the division, the rage, and how the media and a lot of the these political shows continue to stoke that rage. It's a dead
Bro,
end. It's a dead end, folks. I'm sorry,
I
anybody
think you
watching.
said earlier that we have an addiction to rage. I think that's or something in that vein. And it's like, oh man, that does seem to be a major thing that's being pushed to us all the time, is just outrage.
Yeah, somebody told me this in an interview last week, and it's so powerful. She said, "We would rather be right than be walking in love." And I was like, "Whoa!" But I'm a pastor's kid, which is so funny. I don't preach that much, but I was thinking if I did do a sermon, if I got called to put on, if I was called to be put on some kind of circuit while I was doing a sermon, Paul said the three greatest things, and I'm paraphrasing, pastor's paraphrase here, but the three greatest things in the universe are faith, hope, and love. But above all of that is love. And I think people are switching out like their political rage and somehow conflating that into their faith. And it's just making it this real hateful thing. And it just goes back to scripture, man. It's like I can speak with the most eloquence of tongues and all these different things. But if I don't have love, man, I'm nothing. I'm
Like
just
a
I'm
banging
making
gong.
yeah, I'm making noise. It's like it's completely useless. And so man, I think I think culturally we need to reevaluate where we're at. Steven Spielberg made this sweet little movie in the 80s called E.T. We're at the height of the Cold War. And there are many historians that believe that E.T. contributed in a mass cultural way to prematurely ending the Cold War with Russia. Like there was such a call for kindness and love of the other and beauty and coming together in that movie that it impacted us on a global scale and it changed history. And so anyway, I think film has a really strong power to do that. But yeah, my overwhelming theme and call and really plea to the church and our culture at large, even Hollywood to a degree, is kindness, love, compassion, belonging, empathy. I believe these to be the core tenets of faith, and I mean, I read the whole Bible when I was 18, and I've spent a lot of time working my way out of the cultural constructs that people try to build around Jesus. I'm like, man, let's look at who he really was and what he really did, because we know that you can build whatever culture around Jesus that we want to as humanity. We can do that. So you have the slaveholders back in the day, and you have the abolitionists. Like they're building cultures around Jesus, and they were using Jesus to say different things.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah. And so we have to be careful about that, because I think, again, today we find ourselves in a time where people are building improper cultures around who he was and what he stood for and who he is. So anyway, don't let like I will spend the rest of the time talking about this. So we should probably find something else to talk about. But yeah, man, it's
Can I
strong.
make one more comment on that circle and then we
Of
can move
course.
on? Okay, I
Of
didn't know if that
course.
was your like end it. I didn't know if that was a firm be done.
No, what I'm saying is I'm so passionate about it, I'll hijack the rest of
Oh,
the interview.
gotcha. No, you're fine. This is good. And this is something that sat with me since the film, especially because, like I said, I went down like a wormhole watching interviews and then also just seeing other people's thoughts back to the film. And, one thing that really sat with me, I mean, I guess we're saying the same thing, but it's just we are in an interesting time in culture. And I think that there's a lot of Christians who maybe, and maybe I'm projecting here or making this up, but I think that maybe there's a lot of Christians that feel like confused on how to handle everything that's changing in the world. Like, what do we do? Okay, we'll open up the doors to the hippies, but then do we say anything if we feel like, hey, you're potentially like nosediving your life down this path that we don't feel like is biblical and you're maybe hurting yourself. Like, do we say something? And I think that because of all of this divisiveness and rage, that's a good word, that's happened. I mean, tale as old as time in some ways, right? Rage, but also especially in the last few years, I think that there's maybe a lot of people that have either become hardened, like they've shut down their heart or they've closed off their world, or they just don't even know what that means. Like, what does that mean to like open the door to the hippies, to these people that live this completely different lifestyle than maybe we feel is right, or that we feel like God's calling us to, or we don't even know how to handle it? And I felt like in the film, and you would know better because you made it and I didn't, but one thing I took from it was this level of like, or this element of remaining like soft and open to people from different backgrounds, and not because of maybe pain or interactions that I or other people have had with people who live a completely different life. And you're just like, oh, they don't want to hear it. They don't want to talk to me. They're mad at me, whatever, I'm shutting down. And it's like, whoa, 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 no, like people are going to be hurt. Like, people persecuted Jesus, but he didn't stop loving them. And I felt like there was an element of this call to just remain soft and remain open. And it doesn't mean like throwing everything, in my mind, at least, like throwing all things to the wayside, any like semblance of how we feel like the Lord wants us to live, and like, whatever, everyone can just do what they want. But it's like not becoming cold and hard and shut down to people who really need the love of God and the love of Jesus. I don't even know where I'm going with that, but just hearing you talk about this, the rage and like the different ways that people are going, and it's complicated. And maybe that's part of why the Bible mentions love so many times, because love is complicated. I don't know. But also not. My husband just gave me a Valentine's card saying that loving me was not complicated. So I'm kidding.
That's beautiful. No, I have many thoughts on that. I think the ultimate universal imperative from Scripture is to love.
Mm-hmm.
It's to love no matter what. So, you know, Jesus loved everybody. Jesus had kind, loving words to a thief on the cross that died before he could get baptized. Like, you know, we have all these like cultural weird ramifications we put around stuff, but you know, he said, hey, today you'll be with me in paradise, you know. But like, he could have been like, no, you're a thief, man. Sorry.
Yeah. And not. On top of that, he was being persecuted. So he was dealing with the pain physically while he was still showing love to this man, not only as the creator of the universe, like, I'll see you in paradise, but he was dealing with his own pain through that. Sorry, I interrupted you, but I just think that that's an amazing human element as well.
He's dying like the most
gruesome,
horrible,
death.
Gruesome, painful, agonizing death on purpose devised by the Romans to like make you feel the worst pain you could possibly feel as you die.
Yeah.
And he's still like thinking about this other person. And he's talking to people. He's talking to God. He's talking to his disciples and his mother. And it's just so beautiful, you know, but like thinking about others. And if you're not loving the other, you're not following the mandate of Jesus. I'm sorry. You're just not. And so like, when I'm really snarky or like, you know, looking at my own life, I'm like, man, maybe I've really only met four real Christians in my whole life, you know, because Jesus said to love your enemies. I mean, like how many people have I seen in my life that have really done that? So I'll tell you a quick story. And this is, you know, people have different tolerance levels of what they watch, but there's this amazing, and I usually don't watch true crime. I find it to be really dark and kind of get me a little depressed, a little down.
Why? But, just kidding. Go on.
Well, there's an amazing one. It won a ton of awards. I think it came out a year or two ago, but it's called The Night Stalker. But it's about the detectives tracking down one of the most gruesome serial killers in LA in the 80s.
Whoa.
And one of the detectives was a Catholic, and his life fell apart trying to track this guy down. Like, you know, he's walking on these guys like crime scenes, and like he killed elderly people. He did bad things to children. I mean, just like the worst possible thing. And he's trying to figure out this guy's motives, and he's analyzing every move, you know, in these crime scenes. It's just so brutal and terrible.
Yeah.
Well, the media releases his name, publicly in the LA papers, and they know that the serial killer is reading the press. And so he gets PTSD, thinks this guy's going to come for his family. He can't sleep. His wife leaves him, takes the children. He gets obsessed with finding this guy and catching him. His life falls apart, loses his family, loses his wife, his children, gets PTSD. And in the last part of the show, they catch the guy, and he dies in prison or whatever. This guy was a Catholic, and his faith was really challenged through all this, like watching this horrible person do these horrible things, these atrocities to other innocent people. But here's where it ends. And I was weeping, man. I was so overwhelmed. This guy's a Catholic, okay? And he made amends with his family, his wife. He gets his wife back. His children come back. He's still with his wife. He's got a good relationship with his children and really had a happy ending. But like all that hell he had to go through to catch this guy, it's just, I can't wrap my head around it. But here's how the show ends. And it haunts me, man. He goes, I'm a Catholic. And while my faith was challenged, I still have faith. I still believe in God and I still pray. He goes, every night, when I say my prayers and I ask for forgiveness for my day and my sins or whatever, and when I finish my prayers, I say that man's name out loud and I pray for his soul. And that guy, I just want to spend days with that guy, like sitting at his feet, because that guy is practicing real faith. And all this dumb stuff that we're mad about, we're raging about, it doesn't matter. For that guy to see the horrors that that human, the evil that he allowed, the conduit into his own life, to carry that evil and manifest it in the world through his own body, and yet he can pray for the condition of that man's soul and pray that he has peace with God. Man, that's real Christianity to me. And that's what I want us to get back to. But that's just, to me, that's one of the most beautiful modern Christian stories I've ever heard.
Well, and you saying that makes me think, and this may be a good segue into the films, it makes me think about I Can Only Imagine, because I was struck again, seeing, I saw that for the first time. I've seen it three times now, which shocked me the other night. I was like, this is my third time seeing this movie. Like, I've seen this a few times. But I saw it for the first time with my mother-in-law, so my other mom figure. It's funny, I saw Jesus Revolution with my mom. I Can Only Imagine with my mother-in-law. And she brought me to that, and we were like a mess in the theater, for a lot of different reasons. Actually, I'm realizing all the connections here. This is wild. That same, my mother-in-law was actually kind of saved through the Jesus movement in the 70s. So she's kind of a product of that, which is wild because it's like their pastors, her kids are all believers now. Her kids, got married to believers. It's crazy. But we were sobbing through that, and part of that was because I Can Only Imagine, she had a rough relationship with her father, and so the portrayal of that relationship was moving in a different way for her. But seeing it again for the third time and getting to the end, the way that you guys told his story so well of him living through these atrocities with his dad and then ultimately walking the road to forgiveness, like we said, which is, I don't even know the way to word it without sounding corny. I was going to say, like, the ultimate Christian virtue. I don't know quite how to word that, but he walked through essentially what you're just talking about, like going through this horrible emotional pain and being able to come full circle and forgive. And now it's a little different because his dad obviously came full circle as well, but it's not different in the sense that, like, a lot of people can't actually get over that or like truly forgive in a way that like their souls are refreshed from it and they're changed. And yeah, you guys conveyed that really well in that film. So okay, I don't know if you want to say something back or if I just keep going and ask you.
I will say something back.
Yeah.
And this is full like vulnerability and transparency. And I'm so glad to be talking to you about this. But I in the past especially have really struggled with forgiveness. My wiring is to hold grudges and to harbor bitterness and resentment and hold on to things and tell victim stories about myself. Like that is how I normally want to show up in the world. So that movie, working on that movie, I knew that about myself, and I pushed, writing it with John, I pushed so hard into forgiveness and trying to understand how Bart did this and really unpack it. But I distinctly remember weeping as I'm scoring the film. I score most of my cues with a piano or a keyboard, but I remember the tears rolling down my face, hitting the keyboard as I'm scoring this
Oh,
film.
man.
But it was so healing. It was so powerful. Like I realized, like, in working on this film, it was something that I needed. But Bart had to go through a process, and John wrote this amazing one line. I think it's probably the most amazing one liner in any of the films I've ever worked on. But he said, when the dad walks into him and says, "I need you to forgive me, man. Yeah, I've done bad stuff. I beat you up. I'm sorry, but I need you to forgive me." And he says, "God can forgive you. I can't." And that resonated with me, man. And so the rest of the movie was about him figuring out how he could become a conduit for God's forgiveness to work through him. I love what you just said, like your soul's refreshed. It's like almost like refreshing a browser page. It's like how do you get that out and like allow it and you may always have some grief and trauma and sadness around whatever happened to you, but holding that person hostage spiritually,
There it is. Yeah.
that is that's not practicing true Christianity, and it's not good for you. You for your own sake too, you need to let it go. So, and that's also an imperative from Christ. It's like there's so much in the Bible about that. Like the guy, I love the story that Jesus told where like the dude, he was like a loan shark or whatever, and he ran out of money and he owed that guy like $1 million, and the dude calls it the $1 million. He's like, "Hey man, you owe me $1 million." He falls on his face, like, "I can't, I'm sorry, I don't." The guy's like, "All right, okay, all right, get him out. He's fine. Just forgive the debt." And the guy immediately goes out in the street and shakes his dude down for $20. And then the dude that he owed the $1 million to found out about it, and he's like, "Throw him in debtor's prison, guys. He's got to learn his lesson." But to me, that's not a hell story. That's the guy putting himself in this perpetual prison in his own soul. Like until you, like you said, how do we get that soul refresh that you just said? Like, can I steal that? That's amazing.
Yeah, steal anything you want. I'll be stealing from you, I'm sure, today.
Okay, great. But no, I mean, love, acceptance, forgiveness. Yeah, man, if we can get back to these core ideals of Christianity. And you know what? The people are going to have, I'm not a Democrat or a Republican. I never will be on either side, but it's okay to have conservative values. I think it's okay to have some liberal values, but there's a way to carry forth your life without hatred and still espouse these views. So to your point, I think that really is the struggle, right? Especially like when you get into, I think for a lot of people, they're just really scared and concerned about certain lifestyles today that are more pervasive and prevalent. What I would say is that's not your job. Your job is to love. Your job is to love, and that's always got to be at the forefront of everything, to me at least.
Yeah, no, it was something that I thought of because now I'm bebopping back to the Jesus Revolution, but just because you brought that up, it was something that I thought of when watching the Chuck Smith character, because I was thinking, oh man, I've been in some positions before in my life. And this is where it gets complicated, right? And I realize we're just having a casual conversation about the film, but I'm thinking out loud. I've had moments in my life before where someone has wanted nothing to do with me because of my beliefs, because it's not to them, it's not just a belief. They're like, well, you are inherently against everything that I am. And I've had some of these conversations where I'm like, no, like, I still love you. I still want to be in your life. And it's not received in the way that I'm trying to bring. It's like, oh no, it's okay. Like, I love you. You do you type of thing. But that's not really what was expected in that conversation. It was a different expectation that they had of me. And it wasn't okay that maybe I had come to a different conclusion. And so that was where in the beginning, when I said this whole thought of like not shutting down in general in life, right? I think that's a good principle. Just because you have a weird experience with someone or something doesn't go the way that you hoped it would. It's like, okay, what can I learn from this moving forward? Is there something I could do better? But then B, how do I not just shut down. Like, oh, I've already tried this or whatever. And it made me think about Chuck Smith, because I was like, man, I wonder, like, and I know, it's, once again, it's a movie. Was he shut down before? Was it a matter of reawakening his heart? Like, hey, don't be so shut down to these people. Like, maybe you've had a bad experience before. I mean, I don't know. I'm putting things out there, but it's something that really had me thinking in the film. Like, and it's the eternal question of life, right? Like, what is love? Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy. It does not boast. It does not self-seeking. It, but walking that out is not only hard, but sometimes hard to even figure out. Like, okay, what's the right thing? How do I do this? I don't even know where I'm going with this statement. But I agree with you, is the point. My dad used to be an atheist, and for him, when he talks about his faith and his radical transformation and being saved, that is the thing he will pinpoint every time. I interviewed him on my channel, his testimony, and he's like, it's love. It's all about love. And I second that, while at the same time, I'm like praying for grace and wisdom and to be like embodied by love as I walk through life and try to figure out how to navigate it. I don't know where I just went with that.
Well, it's hard, right? It's the struggle, because we've all so damaged each other and wounded each other. So, if you're sharing a viewpoint, it's often reciprocated with rage and anger, and you can't have like a civil conversation, right? Like, I just want us to get to the place where we can all maybe respectfully disagree, and also maybe within that context, sit shoulder to shoulder in a house of worship together. Like, nobody has it figured out, but we all are acting like we do. And, so like for me, what's gotten lost in the American Christian society is this idea of sanctuary. So if you went to the atheist kids today, or the LGBTQ kids today, or the kids today, or the kids who are, doing fentanyl or whatever, they don't want anything to do with the church. But if you went to them and said, if the bottom drops out of your life, write down on a sheet of paper the 10 safe spaces that you would go to, I just don't think the church would be on those kids' lists. And that's very sad to me, right? Because this whole idea of sanctuary that's evolved over the millennia, I think it should still be true in our world today. And of course, that's a blanket statement, and there are many churches in the country where they are safe spaces for people that don't believe the same way, that a food pantry or a shelter or an unwed mother or a runaway LGBTQ kid, that came up with their parents and their parents threw them out on the street or whatever, but like if we could open our hearts back up to that way of being, on more of a wider global scale, I think the world would change. And I think people from all walks of life, I think, would become a little bit more receptive to the message. But to your point, when you may, it's really sad, but and this is what I said at the top of our interview, like just some of the cultural entanglements that we find ourselves in and what I've been trying to tangle out of my own life. Like what some people, it's really interesting. Also, if you had them get out a piece of paper and write what a Christian is, they're going to write all these negative, hateful things. Like, well, a Christian hates me because I'm LGBTQ. A Christian hates me because I do drugs. A Christian is a person who's very moral and doesn't agree with my lifestyle. A Christian is a person who thinks they're better than me. It's like if you had them write that down, at the end of all that, I would say, well, then I'm not a Christian because all those things you just said don't apply to me. I love you. And I care about you. And I think you're not alone. And I actually think you're made in the image of God,
Totally.
So if we start pushing that stuff to the side and like get real with people, the other thing is too, right? It's like what you spoke to before. We're afraid. They're like, we're in a culture of fear after the pandemic. There's all these political boogeymen that everybody's afraid of. But like when you have a fear construct, anywhere there's fear in your life, there can't be love. And so, like, actually, I think culturally, we've actually lost a lot of our faith because, like, you shouldn't be afraid. At some point, we're going to die. Like, are we afraid of that? But in the midst of all that, man, if you can push the fear to the side, it's like my mom reminded me of a verse today before I started my interviews. I'm actually here in
Oh,
Texas,
mom.
helping them move. They're moving to they're downsizing to a smaller house, which is cool. But all that to say, she reminded me of a verse that said, "Perfect love casts out fear." And
Yes.
so if we can get into love, you're automatically like reducing that fear. And I think when that
Totally.
comes down, I mean, dude, if there's a sweet old lady watching this podcast right now and you're like afraid of the LGBT community, if you just get into love and if you sat down with a gay person or a lesbian girl or a trans person, you would find love in your heart for that person. And if you don't, there's something wrong. There's something wrong, And so I think we're just called to love, man. Like we're called to love to the point of loving our enemies. And
Yes.
until we can aspire to that, we haven't done enough work. And I'm talking to myself. I'm
Totally.
talking to my, I'm not preaching to anybody. I'm saying this is my observation, and this is like the mountain that I'm trying to climb right now.
And it's interesting too. I don't know what your thoughts are around this. And we will circle back to the movie, but it's all part of the movies, right? Those two especially. But it can be hard to grapple with sometimes as a believer because simultaneously in that same breath, it's like Jesus said, they hated me first, so they're gonna hate you. And so there's also this element of like, okay, why'd they hate Jesus? Like, why did they hate him? Was it because he was, I mean, we know there's a lot of reasons, right? He was saying he was the son of God. He is God. I think that was obviously a huge cultural shake up there, and hanging out with I don't know what the word would be, not the downtrodden, but people who were not like the Pharisees or the, I can't remember the name of the other group other than the Pharisees. There's a second group, but it's skipping my mind. But that is, I think that's an interesting thing too that can trip people up sometimes. Like, oh, well, they just hate me. So, like, whatever, Jesus said they'd hate me. It's like, okay, but we still gotta evaluate. Just because someone is angry at you doesn't mean that you're in the right, but it's this weird, like, I don't know. Once again, I'm speaking out of my own experiences of like when someone gets mad at you because maybe you don't agree with them and you're like, it's easy to be, oh, people hated Jesus. They'll hate me too. And there might be truth to that. But I think that there's also the element, like you said, of not wanting to make people feel like you're looking down on them or judging them. Is there anything I did or said in my energy, in my conversation that conveyed anything other than the emotion that I would be proud before God to have shared with them, like love and acceptance? And I don't know. It's just an interesting dichotomy of like, it is all about love, but then Jesus said that, and you're like, okay. So where does that come in? I don't even know what I'm asking exactly.
Well, I mean, people did hate him. I think mostly inside the very entrenched religious and political communities of the day, right? The moralists, the legalists, they did hate him. But it's really cool. I've been being schooled up by some scholars, and even the parable of the prodigal son was highly offensive. It was highly offensive to them culturally because the way the story should have ended was the kid comes home and they all stone him in front of the father.
Isn't that
So when the
interesting?
father says, "Let's have a party," my son came home, that immediately brought great shame upon him because he didn't have the guts to like stone his own son, which is what he should
Interesting.
have done in culture. So every little story that he told was like a little not a jab, but he was just constantly blowing up their island. And like very like so everyone told like the story of the Good Samaritan. He was like, "Well, one of your guys walked by and just totally ignored it. And then another one of your guys walked by." But then this ethnic minority that is disparaged by you guys and despised as a lesser, he pulls the guy up out of the gutter, spends his own money, rehabilitates him. Who's the neighbor? And so he constantly had just a little bit of like just pull like a spiritual hand grenade and throw it out and just see what it does. So he was hated, but I think he in general, man, and this is me, I think I am a little more on the liberal side of like how I view Christ and Jesus and like just what he's about. 'Cause I love Jesus. I look up to him so much every day and I'll start crying if I talk about it too much, but like, he was hated, but he went on loving. So you can
That's
find in
it.
those scriptures, like well, the world's going to hate you and there's going to be this tiny remnant. There's probably only going to be, 100 of us that make it to heaven. So we got to just put ourselves in this little castle and, only go to Christian coffee shops and only listen to Focus on the Family
Hey,
because
I
this is
like
the
my local Christian coffee shop. Just throwing that out there. Shout out to Tare. Keep going. I really
No
do.
offense intended. No offense
No, I
intended.
know there's
I'm
no
just
offense. I
saying,
had to make a joke.
the overwhelming idea to some people that are in such fear that, the entire world hates you. You're the only one that has the truth. Therefore, you should, like, basically stay inside the castle keep and not go out and just be safe. Be safe because there's all these crazy people around you that don't have the same views and they hate you. And so just wait to die and try not to sin and say your prayers and you'll go to heaven. But to me, that's missing the entire point of the thing. So Jesus was out with the people doing crazy radical things, and he was hated by the establishment. And so, I don't know, man. The right kind of hate is good. But no matter how hated you feel, you should go on loving because, again, that is the spiritual mandate of Christ. And if you aren't able to do that, you need to strip back your faith and start over at formula at ground zero. That's what we need to be focusing on. So yeah, man, it's crazy. The Bible's crazy too because you can kind of cherry pick different things and turn. I always call it like turning up knobs. So you can turn up knobs in different parts of it and make it feel a different way to you. But like, I just don't think, as followers of Christ, you can get around this idea that he told us we had to love. Like
Oh,
that's a non.
yes. Yes, well, and like you said, but you still keep loving. So like even if you've been hurt, it's been a wild, well, it's been a wild few years for everyone. But it's been a wild few years for my family the last couple, and it's caused me to just examine things in a different way. That's a good way to put it. My first 10 years on YouTube caused me to examine my faith in a different way, and these last 2 years have caused me to examine it in a different way. That's very vague, but I was just as we're talking about all of this, I'm like, yeah, I'm thinking about this, and it's very interesting. Just love, so complicated yet not, but so complicated. So, on that note, I keep accidentally almost using like just casually in a sentence the phrase "I can only imagine." I can only imagine Brett, what you've been through. Like I keep almost using the phrase casually. So I will ask because otherwise we do run the risk of this entire conversation turning into just like two artists talking philosophy and faith, which hopefully people are enjoying this.
Yes,
But I
I
also
hope so as well.
Yeah, but I want to keep hearing some more about the specifics just because, I mean, it's fascinating. And coming out of just watching Jesus Revolution and rewatching, I can only imagine coming out of watching those movies again, they're just really incredible pieces of art and convey such powerful messages. And so I guess circling back to that, how did you first get involved in doing in the project I Can Only Imagine? How did that come about?
It's a great question. Me and John and Andy Irwin, the brothers, the directing duo, we both had our first movies come out the same year in 2012, and we had a mutual admiration for each other. And Andy reached out on his football movie because he knew it needed two editors. And that was 2 years later in 2014, I think we started working on that. So I worked on Woodlawn with them and had a great experience with them on
What
that
was it
movie.
called?
Woodlawn.
Woodlawn. Don't think I've seen Woodlawn yet. But okay, go on. I
It's
just
a
want to write that down.
football movie, but all the feels, man. It's real sweet. You should check it out. It's a good movie. I really did. I really like it.
I wrote it. Wrote it down. Okay, go on.
And so, yeah, we all just had a great experience on that. And I did some story work with John on that movie, and I did a little bit of scoring, and they were able to see some of the hats that I wore. And so they really opened up their world to me on their next movie, I Can Only Imagine. So I wrote it with John. I edited it with Andy. I was the second unit director. I got to do a cameo. I got to score the whole movie. I got to produce the band, the music. I got to do everything I wanted to do. I even worked in art department one night, So I like
Wow.
got to do everything,
I know it's not proper to bring up Kanye West anymore, but I always think of Kanye when I hear people that are like, I wear every hat, which is like how I feel in my fantasies, but you got to live it out on that film. That's so cool.
Yeah, they just let me do my thing, you know, in all these different silos. And it was really cool because I got to work in John's world with him in the writing, and Andy's world with him in the editorial. And I got to have my world at the end with the score and the music. And
Wow.
so really, we were, you know, we were the top three guys. You know, they thanked me, you know, in many interviews as kind of being the third director on that movie. And so I did a lot on it, and it was cool for them to allow me to do the things that I did on that movie. But yeah, it came about by some collaboration as we went, and you know, continuing to build a rapport together, and just enjoy working together, you know.
So did they say to you, I have two different thoughts I'm thinking. I'm going to go with this one first. Did they say like,
Okay.
hey, we're working on this project. We have this story. We need to flesh it out into a screenplay. And then you guys fleshed that out together. Were they already working with Bart and Mercy Me or I don't know, maybe this is too detailed of a question.
Yeah, it's a little bit it could get us in the weeds. I'll try to do it like 30 seconds or less, but you hear the story all the time if you keep interviewing people in the film, but like movies burn down all the time and they blow away. So this movie had been trying to get made for 7 years, and there was already a script circulating around, and there was all kinds of stuff. And but it resurfaced again, and John and Andy said, yeah, we'll do it, but we need to start over. At ground zero, we need to start over and rebuild it. And so I didn't even read the old script. I don't know that John Irwin did or not, but I was like, I don't want to read it. Like, if we're starting over, I don't, I assume, you know. So we wrote it, we made it the best that we could. I put everything in that I knew that I could bring to it. And so yeah, it rebooted after 7 years, and we got to make it on the second try because they could never get it off the ground. And some, you know, some similar things happened with Jesus Revolution. It fell apart a couple of times. This is the third time that we tried to make this movie. So took 7 years to make Jesus Revolution too.
Wow, isn't
So
that wild?
yeah, you really have to believe in something and have a lot of passion, because sometimes Hollywood is where scripts go to die. Like, one out of 1,000 scripts will even go into development, and then out of development, only 1 in 1,000 will proceed to production. And then out of that, you know, only a handful will, you know, will go to the theater. I mean, it's every time you make it to a checkpoint, you're like, okay, can we, you know,
No, dude,
it's,
literally, yeah, sorry, keep going.
no, I mean, so yeah, that was the long, you know, circuitous route for Imagine. But it really was beautiful, I think. It's just a beautiful story about Bart never giving up on his dreams, but also finding a path of forgiveness and really doing what he felt like he should do as a follower of Jesus. And yeah, man, it just has profound cultural impact. And it's Dennis Quaid's best acting ever. And
It was good. I was going to say two things to you about that film in particular, and they're totally different points. But the first one was the music in the film. I hope you don't hate me for saying this, but when I was watching it, I kept thinking like, oh man, they could have gone any direction with this music. And they went this really cool, like, don't hate me, almost Blade Runner vibe. It was like kind of futuristic and like it could have just been like acoustic guitars, you know, and that would have been like, oh, it's the cool pop. But it was like it almost like, well, not almost, it did. It helped just one more thing to make it not cheesy. It was like a cool vibe to the music. So maybe that's weird.
No, dude, you're brilliant. You're like a film scholar. Okay, I'm gonna
Oh
break
my
that
gosh.
down. Why I'm gonna break that down. Why that is such an epic statement for that score.
Love it.
I wanted to do an 80s retro analog synthesizer score, and they were like, "Oh, that's weird." Okay, you know, and they
That's
let me do it. You know,
so
they let me
cool.
do it. But when you said Blade Runner, there's this old Yamaha synthesizer that Vangelis used, the Greek composer for Chariots of Fire and Blade Runner. It's called a CS80. It's a Yamaha. Well, I had samples from that CS80 that I used in I Can Only Imagine. So there's the Blade Runner synth actually presenting in that score. So when
Wait,
you
that's
said Blade
actually
Runner,
the Blade Runner synth that's in there.
yes,
Wow.
I have a sample version of that synthesizer. There's only a handful of them left, and they're like $30,000 to buy one, and they go out of tune really easy. So I would never own one, but they're, you know, you have these guys, amazing technicians, that are able to sample that sound and recreate it. So I use like a synthesis version of it. So, but I had the Blade Runner synth sound all
That
the
is
way through that.
so wild. Well, I mean,
Yeah,
I it was a vibe you picked up, and I really did think that. I'm like, they really could have gone like a very expected route, and I do think that that music is a part, right? It all comes together that like that made that story elevated because it was unexpected and it was cool. So that's the first thing. So go you. The second
thanks.
thing is, you're welcome. And this is something that was present in both films, obviously. Everyone has said this to you, I'm sure. But the fact that you guys were able to, and I guess specifically pointing back to, I can only imagine, the fact that you guys were able to convey adult content, adult subject matter, like abuse and alcoholism, in a almost PG way that was like, I could show my kid this. Like he might be scared. That's the point, right? It's not a good thing, but he's not going to be seeing someone get their butt kicked and like the F words flying around. It was really incredible, like I said, in both films, but I know we're talking about that one, to see that unfold. The presentation of something that's like adult subject matter, very serious and actually reaching to the root of the issue without, yeah, putting something on screen that maybe, I mean, maybe a way to put it is that it doesn't need to be there. And that's certainly what those two movies made me feel like. It was a feeling of like, okay, so I'm not crazy. We don't have to go into some of these issues, like every little detail and all the swearing and all the, like, we don't need all the nudity and all the things to convey the same heart message and to really move people through the story. And you guys did that in both films. And I can only imagine. Yeah, Dennis Quaid's acting was amazing. The lead actor, which I don't remember his name, he was amazing. Like I kept thinking that. I'm like, wow, like not only his voice, if that was his voice was amazing, but just all around the story, it was great. So that was another point.
John Michael Finley, that was his real voice. He's an amazing, amazing Broadway singer. Incredible. All that was him. Every drop of that was his real voice.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, so in the domestic violence, we would often cut away. We felt like we could show it and intimate it without showing a kid get beat up on screen.
Yes.
Like who?
Yes.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? So, and then the same thing on Jesus Revolution. And some critics have accused us, rightfully so, right? Like, I mean, to get it to be PG-13, we had to sand some edges off. I mean, if you did everything that happened in the Jesus Revolution, there were some dark corners to that, man. There were cults that came up, like massive sexual abuse. I mean, there's some wild stuff that happened that's really dark and sad. So we wanted this to be a very buoyant, joyful movie, and we didn't want to overwhelm you know, audiences. We wanted to be an a movie that Christian audiences would go see and be proud of and be able to take their kids to. So I'm proud of it, man. I'm proud of it. Like, I feel like we threaded the needle. So, you know, we frustrated some critics because they want us to go as hard as we could at it. And
That's right.
It would have been a super hard R rating. And I didn't want to make that movie. I wanted to make a movie that tons of people could go see and enjoy, that a Gen Z kid could take their grandma to, that a soccer mommy could take their little kid to, you know. So I'm very proud of where we landed. And obviously, you know, if we had put everything in, it would have been a much harder movie. But I think there's still enough truth and authenticity and vulnerability in the movie to merit, you know, sanding down some of those edges so more people could watch it. So I'm glad we took that route. And, you know, you can't please everybody. And we just went with a wider audience on this one. And I'm very glad we did that. I will tell you a very funny story though, because we were working with the MPAA. So I'm
are
a
you talking
beekeeper.
Are you talking about Jesus Revolution or I Can Only Imagine?
Jesus Revolution.
Okay.
So we're working with the MPAA to get our rating. And I'm a beekeeper and my apprentice has two little kids. So in the middle of us, like getting the film where it was going to be a PG-13, we brought her two little kids up to watch it and they loved it. But then the MPAA hit us back 2 days later and they're like, Well, your current cut is definitely rated R. So I had to
Ooh.
call my friend. I
You're
had to
all.
call my friend and go, yeah, we just showed your little kids a rated R movie. So anyway, they thought it was really funny.
That's funny.
But no, we ended up having to back off on a little bit of some of the shots and the drug use, and PAA was really, I felt like they really supported our film, but you know, we definitely had to, we were trying to be as authentic as we could, you know, but we ended up having to come back even a little bit more, you know, in some of, you know, showing some of the drug use. But I really loved where the movie landed, and I thought the NPA had you know, what would you say, real criticism of, you know, of it. So working with them, I think, made it better too. So yeah.
Yeah, dude, I think you guys landed in a great spot. I think that there are times when I first reached out to you, I said this about the movie as a whole. I said, man, how many times do I go see a movie and our joke is like, who sat in a room and was like, this movie has to be made? And it's like discouraging and like just a dumb plot. And no, you guys with this film not only did leave me with the opposite feeling of like, finally, a movie that like had a reason to be made, but also I've left many films where I felt like there was like, if the word is gratuitous, like an over the top amount. I'm like, I'm traumatized from this movie. I'm not even kidding. There's like certain movies where now I know kind of what to look out for. I've seen things in the past where it's like that was literally traumatizing. And I think what you guys proved through both of those movies is that you can convey a serious, not only story, but a serious emotion, and you can get people on that level without having to traumatize them. You know, and
Yeah.
I'm laughing, but it's actually not funny, you know, like a lot of the times those over the top scenes, it's like the person is being like, it's a traumatic part of their story. And now we have to experience that. And you guys just did a great job of conveying that in a way that wasn't traumatizing.
Man, that's such a cool way to say that. I've really been thinking about that a lot. When I was younger, I loved scaring people and pranking people and making people think terrible things are gonna happen. And I don't know. I just don't. I mean, it was funny, and I could tell you some really funny stories, and we would laugh. But trauma is a real thing, and triggering people. I mean, terrible things have happened to people in their real life, and so I'm all about trigger warnings. I think that's important because, hey, trigger warning. There's a scene that depicts this certain type of violence, and you know, some people, that's in their real story. They don't want to see that, and I'm all about that, man. I've really started thinking, do I want like real guns on set? Like, I don't know. I'm like reevaluating everything I want to be about as a filmmaker. And maybe some of that stuff's still important in your stories. But
Yeah, it's
yeah,
like a
man,
per
trauma.
case.
Yeah, trauma is real. Trauma is one of the most detrimental things to society, to a life. And if I won the lottery, I would go back to school and study to be a trauma counselor, is what I would have done. I've really been rethinking my life in those terms and what I choose to put on screen and to leave out, because the last thing I'd want to do is traumatize anybody. We need to be working to reduce trauma in our world, not add more traumatic episodes to people.
Well, I think you guys did a good job at that because really I've felt the opposite with a lot of films where I'm like, man, you could have told this story. Like that didn't have to be there, or at least it felt like that. And yeah, you guys did a great job at that. There's two other things that I will be mad if I get off this call and we don't get to bring them up. I'll be like, no.
Okay.
Okay, so
Great.
the first thing is just closing that loop on the music, in the Jesus Revolution versus I Can Only Imagine. And you did do the music on the Jesus Revolution as well, right?
I did.
Okay, you ready for my second annoying comment?
No, dude,
The
go
Blade
for it.
Runner one didn't fall flat, so I'm feeling like a little more confident in saying it. But oh gosh, it's just always embarrassing to put yourself out there and say this because it's like you may not be a fan at all. But there were choices within your music that kind of reminded me in moments in the Jesus Revolution. Oh, and it's also annoying because it's not like he trademarked this. Oh, I'm so basic, bae. But I feel like Hans Zimmer is known for doing these like one note powerful moments where it's like not or overly orchestrated in like the right moment. You're like, oh, that was good. It was a single note. It was powerful. And I felt like there were moments in the film where it was that, where it was just like you weren't going over the top with the music, but the tone and the notes that you were choosing were like, I don't know, music is vibrations and math and emotion and whatever. And it was like the perfect note that was hitting. I don't know, it's weird, but I think you're getting my gist.
Dude, no offense taken. That's a huge compliment to me. I'm a storyteller and a filmmaker, but I'm also a musician. But like, there are guys that are Juilliard trained or Berkeley, guys that are just, they're way better musicians. I'm actually not even really a great musician. I'm really not.
I
But
believe you.
what,
No,
yeah,
not because
what?
you're mute, but because I just believe people that put things together often they're good at. I just believe you is the point. Go on.
Yeah. So for me, I talk about this a lot, but there's a dark art to scoring. It's not about the music. It's about supporting the scenes. It's about supporting the actors, supporting what's already happened in the scene. So you're a bit of a ghost in the room, and you don't want to be a poltergeist. You want to be a ghost. So if you're a poltergeist, you start, dishes start flying everywhere. It's like you don't want to bring attention to yourself. You want to hide. You want to hide in plain sight. And so when you say Hans Zimmer, that means a lot to me because, man, like some of the stuff that he's done, he really did not make it about the music. He made it about supporting the scene and supporting the film. If I was desert islanded, I would take the Interstellar score with me. That score changed my life. It got me closer to God, man. Like I don't know how he did it. I love that movie. That movie says a lot about my spirituality and my religion, for sure. But yeah, dude, that is not a slight in any way. That's a huge compliment because I try to pump the least amount of music that I can into the score, and I try to make it be the one thing, as you say, that supports the emotion and the authenticity of the thing. And often you can do it with very little music, almost on a preschool level, So that's where I find myself working is just in primary colors and just, doing the least amount of music possible to support the performance. Scenes and so.
Well, I didn't think, I mean, dude, Hans Zimmer is amazing. I've seen him and his whole group or whatever in concert twice, one of them in Nashville, and it was literally life-changing, like so epic. Signed up for his like Hans Zimmer masterclass, couldn't get through two lessons. I was like, I'm not a musician. I don't even know what I signed up for. But he's epic. I only made that joke because I feel like even if you know nothing about composing, it's like so basic bay to know Hans Zimmer, but I love him. His work is so moving. And that's what reminded me when there were just those single note moments. I was like, this is powerful. It's good. So, along those lines of like powerful, just like good moments in the film, this is the one that I have to talk about. I was like, I can't get off this call without this being brought up, is the baptism scene. I had no idea till I got back. I mean, this is life, right? You think something and you're like, I'm the only one that noticed it. And then you look it up and you're like, oh, well, everybody was talking about. When I left that movie, I was like, Mom, that baptism scene felt like I was watching, like, I was like, not to be dramatic, but it felt like cinematic history. Like, it felt like a real moment. And I was just really blown away by it. And once I started watching videos, I was like, okay, like a lot of people felt that same way. We all felt the same way. And then I started hearing from people that it was in one take. Is that true-ish? Am I making this up? If I am, sorry.
Which part of the scene exactly?
When Greg Laurie goes out and gets baptized by I've heard his name a million, Lonnie Frisbee, when he goes and gets baptized by him in the ocean and they're like head to head and the
Oh.
sun is setting behind them. And I was like, this is like a masterful moment because you can't control nature and the sun is setting right now.
Yeah.
Even
No,
if
that
it's
was
not in one take, you take it away.
no.
I just had to say that.
No, that was in one take. We were losing the sun, and we were behind, and we had to start doing some crazy stuff just to cover the script. So when they were running up to the beach, and he's like, "I'm not nervous," and she's like, "It's just water." And the argument, and I think we got that in one take. We were just running out of time, and we got him out there, and it was just perfect, man. I mean, but yeah. What was on the chopping block too was all that underwater stuff because we didn't have it on the schedule, and I was like, guys, we have to shoot this. And so the producers gave me what's called a day zero, which means on like a prep day, you get to take a skeleton crew and go shoot a little something. So they let us have one day the weekend before we actually started the real schedule, and we put Joel in that. It was a diving tank, is what it was, like an indoor diving pool. It was 15 feet deep, and we blacked out everything. And but yeah, it's just such
Wow.
a the, all that Sylvia. And I think overwhelmingly, that scene is people's favorites. And then my favorite scene is Chuck washing the feet of the hippies.
Oh, that is
That
such a good moment as well. I just got
brings
chills
me to tears.
again.
Yeah, brings me to tears every time I see it.
Yes. No, I mean, you're right. Those moments, that's, I hadn't thought of that one right now. I literally have chills all over me right now, but that moment is just, that moment is so powerful as well. I think for the reason that the baptism scene floats to the top of my mind, besides the fact that like basically every believer ends up making their proclamation known and getting baptized, so it's like very relatable. Like, wow, watching him literally be born again. But the, just the capturing of the whole moment. I guess that's the real point. Like the acting, the lighting, the fact that you guys got that, it felt so just genuine and very, I don't know how to say this without sounding corny, even though I've sounded corny the whole interview. Like a reminder of my own baptism, a reminder of the gravity of the decision being made, of the new life beginning, of what it is like when you emerge from that new life. And I'm really glad that you got that scene with, what was the actor's name again?
Oh, Courtney.
Joel. I'm glad you got that scene with Joel because the underwater part honestly was just as powerful and helped to elevate the out of the water part because the sunset coming down was so striking. And then for him to be under that water and it was like a rebirth moment. It was, I'm really glad that you got that. That was cool.
Yeah,
And
man.
then not to take away from your favorite scene, which is also the foot cleaning moment, that scene was really good too. His look to camera, the way it came up, like all of it was great.
And really quick, bragging on, I know we got to go, but bragging on the actors, so many of the funny moments were just actors. We just let them be and just let them play. And so much of the humor in the film, it's just the actors just doing their thing, and some great lines that they even added to the script. And so it's just wonderful to see it all come together. And it was definitely a labor of love, and a bunch of us have been working on it for a very long time. And we're just so happy that it's out in the world, and she's having a life of her own and doing good. And definitely try to. Did you see it with the crowd? Was like your theater busy? Was
Oh
it
my
full?
gosh, it was packed. And every person I've spoken to, which makes sense because I've seen you, but you've been sharing the box office numbers. It makes sense that all the theaters are full. But everyone I've talked to has said the same thing. Like I went in and it was full. So yeah, it was a crowd. Everyone's laughing and crying, and it was amazing.
Yeah, I would say if you can see it with a crowd, it's just such a fun communal hippie experience. It's everybody like sharing this moment together, and it's just really fun. It's a fun crowd movie. It's the best crowd movie I've ever done. And so see it with a crowd if you can.
Well, dude, Brett, I am really glad that we got connected. You can probably tell from this whole call that I geek out over getting to talk to creators and people that are like pouring their heart and soul into making something beautiful and worthwhile. And I really am excited to see, like, just as this movie continues to go on, what it does in people's life, how the Lord uses the story that you guys brought to life in people's lives now. Besides just obviously the echo of the actual event, but I'm excited to see, just as more people see it, what it does. And I'm glad that God worked through you guys to make this happen. It's really awesome and inspiring to me as a creator.
Thank you for all that. I'm just excited to meet you as a friend and just to be a buddy,
Too.
man. I can't wait to keep chatting with you and hear more about your life and meet your family. And yeah, man,
Oh.
thanks for having me on. If you guys are ever through Nashville, man, bring your whole brood over to meet the goats.
Oh, I would love that. We'll be back at some point. I told you we lived there for a couple of years. My sister's still over there. My other sister's husband's family is over there. So we'll be back at some point and we'll be playing with your goats and bees.
I love it, man. Do it. Do it. Come
Well,
by, man.
thank you, Brent. I hope that
Thanks.
you have a good rest of your day. I hope that all your interviews and press stuff goes well and that you're able to just have a nice, even energy day.
What a beautiful conversation. Thank you for the the questions, and thank you for that Blade Runner drop. You blew my mind, dude.
Dude, my mind is blown that your mind is blown. You're leaving me walking away from this interview being like, oh my God. So I am like a, I'm like a professional film analyzer. I don't
You are. Don't
Wow.
let anybody tell you any different, man. You got the juice.
Thanks. I'll be clinging on. I'll be clinging on. Well, I
Yeah,
hope you have a
man.
good rest of your day, and I will talk to you on the internet. And yeah.
Thank you.